Hey, yo, and here we go. Another episode of We Talk Music is on the air and in your ear. And we just got no time to fool around here, Brett. Who was our guest?
Oh, well, we have a fantastic guest, one that we've been looking forward to talking to for years and years. He is the vocal. He's a singer-songwriter in his own right. He's sung with Freak of Nature and, of course, the big one, White Lion. We have Mike Tramp. And, Mo, I know there's something you want to say to Mike.
Yeah, good out. How'd it got?
Yeah, how's it going?
Yes, I am. No, nobody else. Brett doesn't speak any Danish, so we'll end it there. We won't keep going in
and
that.
I don't think the world needs to speak Danish right now.
No, I don't think so either. I don't think, and I don't speak it as well as I understand it. But I was born in Denmark myself, so you know.
Oh, you really, were okay.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I was born in Denmark and moved to Canada actually when I was just before my third birthday. You know, lived in Canada, but all my roots and my family and everybody like that is over there. And I know it's been a tough time. I've been getting a lot of updates from my family about what's been going on and everything. But, you know, that's one of the main reasons why I'm so excited to talk to you, to be honest.
We're all in the same boat.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's right.
Absolutely. So, Brett, I'll kick it back over to you for the first question.
All right. Well, the main reason that we are here is to talk about Second Time Around, your new album, Mike. And that one is currently due out on May 1st. I don't know. I know things have been changing, of course. I know Frontiers changed a lot of their releases, so I'm not sure if Mighty Music is going to change theirs. But for right now, Second Time Around. Let's talk about it.
We're not going to change our release date. I mean, if this was the old days where you had 500 record stores around the country ready to receive the boxes being delivered by trucks, that'd be a different story. These days, you know, I sell 50% via the web store. I maybe sell 30% at my show. So, you know, the other 20% that go down to the local record store, you know, will survive on that, you know. It's just the way it is, and we're just going to deal with it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's all we can do, and I think, you know, it's very interesting because, I mean, we've talked a lot to musicians about just the sense of, you know, how much music means to them right now. So maybe speak to that, you know, how much your music means to other people. I mean, I know it certainly means something to us.
Well, I mean, for many years, you know, let's just for a quick second go back to the mid 80s when as White Lion started breaking into the market and then suddenly we hit it big and stuff like that. You know, this is like getting caught in the middle of like a vortex. You know, I don't know what the hell went on. Everything went so quickly. You didn't have a chance to even look to make up any decisions. You followed along and you were scared to be left behind. You made decisions based upon that. And 25 years later, when you look back, you wish you had a moment to catch your breath and then think it over if that's exactly what you wanted to do or if you wanted to do something else. You know, as time goes by and you start grabbing hold of yourself, you know, I became my own manager in 2002, and I've been my own manager ever since. I do everything myself. You know, I've always written all the songs myself and things like that. So, I mean, you know, I'm just a mom and pop store and things like that. So it's quite simple. It's really just that I'm, you know, trying to fit into this ever-changing music business that's, you know, necessarily not anything that benefits me. So I have decided over the last 10 years to bring the music to the people. So this is the traveling, you know, salesman, you know, with the rental car with, you know, like 20 boxes of CDs, T-shirts, and vinyl in the back of it and acoustic guitar, and then going out there and playing the shows for like 100, 150 people every night. And I'm damn happy about it.
Well, I mean,
actually, yeah. Oh, go ahead, Brett.
No, I was just going to say, we're happy that you're still out doing it. So
it's actually one of the things that I noticed.
What else am I going to do? I mean, it's, you know, not that I can't do something else, but when you've given your life for 44 years to one specific course, you don't just go down the next day and work at Home Depot.
So actually, it's very interesting because I didn't realize that you had started in 1976. I mean, yesterday we were talking to Dennis DeYoung from Styx, and he started in 1972, and that's Styx. And I think of, White Lion as being a generation after
I
him. But
know.
you know, it's really amazing.
I know. It's I can't even fathom it. I mean, it's that many years, it's that long of a journey that I sometimes don't believe it happened.
Yeah, and I actually listened to Boom Boom by Mabel today. I was in preparation for
Of
this,
course
so
you did.
all I can say is it was a different time, wasn't
It was a different time.
It was a different time. A lot of your songs, on this album and a lot of your albums, one thing I do know is you talk so much about being on the road, about traveling, being away. It seems to be very, very, I don't know, important part of what you're exploring in your life and musically.
Yeah, I mean, I think of course, also, I mean, the first single is called The Road, but let's use the road more as a metaphor, not necessarily the road. When you attach a rock band and the road, then you talk about a band being on the tour. But to me, my life is a road, an endless highway where the exits that I pull off at any given time represents, for example, each of the last 12 solo albums that I've done. And this is, as I sit in the car and I turn it off and I look back, I look forward, and I stay in the moment I in, that represents the stories and the songs of each album. And it's an ongoing journey. The character is the same person on every album. He's just somewhere else or somewhere different on each album. But the mission is the same, and that's basically to get to the place where he doesn't know where he's going.
Well, it's really interesting because this you feel like almost like the great American songwriter, only you're Danish, and so you've got some of those elements of like a Bruce Springsteen now, where it's just you're telling these stories, and all the stories and the songs are so they're so real, like you can reach out and touch them almost. But I mean, that's such a big part of your songwriting.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about Denmark. I mean, I grew up with my mom and my two brothers in a little apartment in Copenhagen, and she would wake us up every morning to either Elvis or Roy Orbison or Dylan or Johnny Cash. So my foundation to my music and my songwriting and my guitar playing is 100% folk. Including a lot of the 60s and early 70s Danish folk singers. That is what I brought to the table when Vito Bratta and myself were sitting writing the early songs of White Lion. We were writing the songs in that environment. He would sit with the Stratocaster, I would sit with the acoustic guitar, and we would write the songs, and we wanted the song to work in that. In that version, we weren't saying, well, when we get into the studio and the big drums come on and the reverb and the big harmonies and stereo and everything like that, then it'll be a great song. No, we knew it was a great song when we wrote it there because it felt like we were sitting there, just playing a Beatles song or something like that, that didn't need all this other fuss around to be a song that you could sing along with. And that is the way I've written songs my entire life. There were a period in White Lion, of course, where we were in a decade of very visually loud rock and roll, where the videos and the stage performance was almost as important as the songs. I got caught many times in a bit of a dilemma where I was fighting a natural instinct of not wanting to write like Bret Michaels or David Lee Roth when it came to lyrics. I was not very good at faking a party. It did not appear to me as something I wanted to write about. And when you go back and listen to White Line, there's very little of it. And even at times when I try to do it, I don't think I completely succeed with it because it's so unnatural for me to think that way. I was never in rock and roll for the after party. I was never in rock and roll for all that other stuff. I was in rock and roll because I loved music and I wanted to be in that world. Once White Lion and once the 80s were over and I started my second band, Freak of Nature, it was one of the first things I grabbed hold on and says, now the songs, especially the lyrical-wise, will represent at that moment the band, where we are in life, how we see the world, what we are facing, issues in the world, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of this has to do with me being raised in a country of 6 million people where at a very early age in school, we are very much introduced to the entire globe. Not just that we are in a little country, but that we are aware of history and that there are many other countries and many different cultures. When I was living in America and the 22 years that I lived in America, the happiest time in my life, I basically felt that there was no other world than America. And it just wasn't something that creatively was very rewarding for me. I wanted to write, and I remember when White Lion were recording our third album, Big Game, and I presented songs like Little Fighters. I've written this song about the story of a little fishing trawler belonging to Greenpeace, blown to pieces by the French Secret Service because it was trying to prevent nuclear testing down in New Zealand. And I've written a song about apartheid in South Africa. And the record company and the management and the band are sitting there with the jaws in their laps going, what the hell are you doing, man? People want to hear, look what the cat dragged in.
Oh, when you describe Little Fighter sounds to me like a single. You know? It's actually probably my favorite White Lion song, I have to say. So that's interesting that to hear you talk about it that way. That it's something it sounds like you had to fight for.
Well, definitely I won that battle, because I just said, it's important, and I think that, looking back now, when I sometimes tell this story on stage that, when you look through a Circus magazine or a Hit Parade or a Metal Edge from the 80s and you go through it like really quickly, kind of the way when you stand in line at the supermarket and you want to go through the National Enquirer or People magazine, you don't really flick pages after pages. You just scroll through it. When you do that to an 80s magazine, it just looks like there's one band. The first 20 pages are blonde hair and the other pages are dark hair. And that basically, tells the story of what an 80s band were about. When you scroll through a section of 80s album in a used LP vintage album store, you also sometimes think it's just one band. But when you take the vinyl out and you put it on the turntable, there is a difference between White Lion, Rat, or Motley Crue.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That is when the music does the separation, not just the talking, but also the separation.
And there was a lot of generic music and a lot of generic bands, but White Lion in that era and that genre never was one of them, ever. Ever. Now this new album, let's get back to it a little bit here. Tell us a little bit about it. Obviously the title Second Time Around is significant.
Yeah. I mean, Second Time Around is basically me having put in the songs that I wrote for that album and have been messing around with from time to time. They sort of somehow got shoved aside and I got on to other projects. Along this whole journey of writing, and releasing a solo album probably about every year and a half and touring of that, I felt a void. I felt that these songs that had so much, meaning to me because they are part of one of the exits on my endless highway, but suddenly that little story is forgotten, but it's a key part of it, of the whole story. I just decided that I needed to go back and pull these songs out and look at what I could rescue and look at what I had to redo and stuff like that. And when it all came together, it was as clear as crystal to me that this is one of the strongest of my trans solo albums. And there is so much of the story that now completes an incomplete story, because the story and the journey is not over, but this is just such an important chapter.
Well, and you did go and had an album, Songs I Left Behind. So the difference between what happened and what you did with that project and what you did with this project, if you can kind of explain the difference between the two.
Yeah, I mean, well, Songs Are Left Behind is unfinished songs and songs from many different sessions from around the world, at different moments in my life and stuff like that. And it's one of those things you put out at a time when you're not releasing a new album. And even though they're all unreleased songs, they're not a complete album because they're recordings from all around the world at different friends' studios and things like that, that I've, ended up in and recorded three songs with someone and three songs with someone else. And they're all sort of, and they never ended up on the next solo album or the one after that. That's a completely different story because, second time around is songs written specific for this album.
And that's obvious, I think, when you listen to the lyrics, songs like No Tomorrow, I mean, have a pointed message for now, and Back to You have a pointed message for now. I think that's, it definitely comes across. I don't know if you feel the same way, but just kind of looking at your career and the evolution of it, I feel like somewhere about, like, it takes a while for a musician to really get to be his best usually. Sometimes their first album is their best album, and yet they're exploring and their growth and the talent and the confidence and all of it comes together at a certain point. And feels like about a decade ago, that was it for you. And since then, you've been making the best music of your life.
Well, I mean, I 100% agree with you. There's no doubt that to me, the first Van Halen album is the best album, and so on and so on. And for many of my favorite bands, their first album is the best album. I also made the comment sometimes, it's a little different that, sometimes when you see some of these, teenagers now show up on, American Idol or X Factor and stuff like, and they're, 15 years old, and then they're singing When a Man Loves a Woman, and they haven't had their first kiss. I had to live a life to sing about it. Mm-hmm. Springsteen came out last year, after he sort of was done with his, 1 year in Broadway show, where he says, I never lived the life I sang about. That was the life my father lived. It's my father's life I lived through. And in many ways, sometimes it becomes like that. You visualize it, and of course, you spoke about, Springsteen before. He happens to be, of course, one of my favorite artists and stuff like that, but he's a human being, and so am I. I'm a human being, and we sing about life, and I'm not afraid singing, mentioning three or four songs on each album about the difficulties in my now 16-year-long, marriage to my wife and stuff like that. These are just facts, and I love speaking the truth. And that's a great reward, putting the words down on paper, and standing behind them, and not being afraid of going up on stage and saying to the audience, I'm going to play this song now. It's called When She Cries. It's a song I wrote about sitting and waiting for my daughter to be born, sitting in the corner of a hotel, of a little hospital room in Copenhagen, Denmark, not necessarily happy, scared, a bit ashamed of how I maybe, were the 9 months my wife carried our child inside, not completely sure of how I was going to respond to it all. And now seeing my daughter be born and now basically asking for forgiveness. And not being ashamed or saying that, I wasn't really planning on having a child. I didn't really want a child. Now that I have children, they're the most important thing in my life. But if I have to tell you the truth, I didn't plan to have children. I didn't want children.
It's interesting. And I think there's probably a lot of A lot of parents feel like that, I think, to a certain degree. I know there's a lot that really want the kids, but then, and I think the rock and roll life doesn't necessarily seem like it lends itself to having children, for sure.
No, of course not. I mean, I gave up my life when I was 15 and a half years old. I didn't finish my high school. I went straight into a rock and roll band. They were 10 years older than me. You know, within 2 weeks, I committed my life to it. 44 years later on, I realized I have no savings, I have no pension, I have no insurance, I have no guarantees, but I've lived on the edge of a knife my entire life. And some people live that life that way. And you know, I haven't lived in a bar. I haven't lived it with a needle in my arm or a straw to my nose and stuff like that. I've seen the world and I met a lot of people. I have friends in all the corners of the world, and there's nothing that I regret. Is it easy now? No, it's damn hard, man. You know, it's my children and my wife live in Indonesia. My oldest son lives in Australia, and I sit, you know, on a half-finished farm in Denmark. And right now, we don't know when we're going to see each other, and I don't know when I'm going back on the road. But that's my life.
That's really interesting. I love that living on the edge of a knife. That's an excellent. I think that's a Hawkwind song, actually. I think that, but it's that's just the idea of that as a lyric. That sounds like we've already started to write your next song.
Well, that's actually a song. They actually lined one of the song on the edge of a knife. He didn't find much love. I mean, that's just a different song, basically written about the Columbine incident happening. But the point is that, you know, I met so many people in my life, you know, that just lives a regular life, and all your life is so exciting, man. It must be so exciting. But they're the ones with all the security. The car's already paid for, you know, the house is paid for. They could go to the bank and get another loan and buy a second house. You know, I couldn't even get a bank loan to buy a house. I had to find another way of doing it and stuff like that. You know, but at the same time, there's also been a lot of times in my life when I get up in the morning and I am the boss and I decide what I'm doing. And I'm, you know, so and so. So it depends. What do you want, danger or security?
Well, and one of the choices that you made too, that I find very interesting, especially as you talk about becoming a parent, is to kind of get away from the US and I mean you had taken your family to Australia at that point to, you know, to get your son educated.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, you probably can add a couple more things to that basket, you know. You know, this is also a time when, you know, this is we're talking about 1999 here, you know, and you know, my first wife at that time, who I moved to Australia with, had also been a big part of the 80s. She was one of the big costume designers. You know, she worked with Kiss, Van Halen, Whitesnake, Scorpions, all the big MTV clothes, Ozzy Osbourne, all that whole stuff. She's the one that did that, and you know. So she crashed as much as the rest of us did when MTV suddenly became, you know, cut off military shorts and just, you know, a t-shirt with a hole in. So we're there. We're sitting up in Lake Tahoe, and looking around and all the rich people, and then saying, "What are we doing here? We don't even have any money in the bank." And then for some reason, she said, "Man, you know, my sister in Australia said we can come live at her farm. Take a year off, you know, with our son, see if we can find ourselves and stuff like that." So, you know, we packed up and we moved to Tasmania. It's basically the last island before you hit Antarctica. And you know, there we sit, and then suddenly after a little bit of a breathing period, you wake up one day and say, "Hey, I'm a rock and roll musician and you're a rock and roll costume designer, and we're living on an island with ferals," you know, and you know, and it's just one of those things, just another drastic, every step that I've taken has been drastic. From Denmark to Spain, from Spain to New York, from New York to LA, from LA to Lake Tahoe, from Lake Tahoe to Tasmania, from Tasmania to Indonesia, and from Indonesia back to Denmark.
How is it that happened, actually? Because you know you guys were obviously studs, and then you came over to North, which is not the best name I have to say for a band. I'm glad you changed to Danish Lion, and then everybody else left. They all went back, and you decided to stay. Why was it you decided to stay when everybody else decided to leave?
Well, you know, sometimes it's just like that, and you don't know the answer before you get there. And now I sort of just feel like I'm coming home to where, you know, my parents and my older brother and my grandparents are buried on a little cemetery very close to where I live right now. And it just seems like it makes sense right now to just sort of, you know, to sort of end where I started out. And there's a sense of peace here. And I still like to venture out into the world and stuff like that. America is not the America anymore that I remembered, et cetera, et cetera. You know, also it's not as easy anymore. So I'm happy sort of being tucked away in a very little town out in the country. You know, I have my own farm, you know, no neighbors, a lot of acres of land and stuff like that. And I've always been one of those, when I came off the road, I never ended up in a barn and stuff like that. I always wanted to go out in nature. I always want to go out in a forest and stuff like that, open plains, open land and stuff like that, you know. In 1980, I bought like 200 acres in the Colorado Mountains and stuff like that. And I thought I was going to build my future and stuff like that until I realized I bought land in altitude of 10,000 feet and only, you know, half a year I could access it. It's just one of those drastic steps. That's my dream.
Well, it's interesting because we talk, you talk about friends and stuff like that, and David Reese, we had been talking to him, and he was trying to get a hold of you for us, and so, but he kept saying, oh, Mike's busy, he's in Indonesia, so it was always one of those, yeah, like, even to us from the side, like, you have this, like, fascinating, like, wow, Mike's in Indonesia, what, like, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, I don't even know how I ended up there, but, you know.
Hey,
back to the album. If you don't, my favorite track is Highway. I don't know what kind of feedback you're getting on people's favorite tracks, and it's actually pretty difficult. Usually, one or two tracks sticks out for me, and this album, because they're all so damn good, it was about my third listen before I realized, you know, I think that's the one that's connecting to me personally the most.
Well, you kind of said that a few times in the interview today, that you sort of come back to a similar feeling that I have myself. I mean, there are many different tracks, and each track has a different story. But that could definitely be that one, together with The Road and stuff like that, could come, you know, would be very, very, probably more typical Mike Tramp than Between Good or Bad and No Tomorrow, because those songs are a little bit more, you know, the main guitar riff. But you know, no doubt that you know, Highway lies there, you know, with, you know, Born to Run and those kind of things, that Highway song, you know, where you know, that you know, those great days when the open roads and the big V8s and stuff like that, and that romantic, you know, scene there that doesn't exist anymore. And you know what, it's just like, it's just wanting to be in it. It's like wanting to freeze time at a moment when you were at that place, you says, this is where I want to be.
One of the things that I find interesting, so when these first came out with the Rock and Roll Circus, like, you have a different sequence. I mean, there's a few more songs on the Rock and Roll Circus album, but this is a different sequence for the album. So in your opinion, this sequence works better for the overall album? Like, I think it does myself, but is that something that you were kind of aiming to change?
Well, I mean, hence the title second time around, because most of your listeners are not aware that this album, in most of this album, got released as something called Mike Tramp and the Rock and Roll Circus. And it is at a time in my life where I'm standing probably, even though I only have two legs, probably with 3 feet in different corners of the crossroads of where the hell I'm heading. And the reason why at that moment I added the Rock and Roll Circus to it was because the band that I was playing on that album, you know, my friends, there was so much, you know, band playing on the songs that I felt, and I actually for a moment thought that it could be a future project, that this would actually be our band. But then at the same time also, before I even went into the studio, I had these songs, and they weren't necessarily written with that in mind. So when I sit back and bring up the songs again, and I listen to the songs, and every single solo album that I've done have been the classic 10 songs, I do feel that it doesn't balance with the 13 tracks. And once I start, picking, what's not fitting in them, it falls together. It all comes together, and I can put, the chapters together. It's interesting enough that Vito and I wrote, the White Lion albums in that way, like a book, song after song, not necessarily in the album order, but we felt that we never ventured into two of the same songs. And we knew that when we got to the point, we says, now we're done, which is also why there doesn't exist anything called White Lion unreleased bonus tracks. and every solo album that I've written, I have not written extra tracks. I write them and I know when I'm done.
Interesting.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's actually very, I think that's very unique in this day and age, where almost every album seems to come out with a deluxe edition a few months later. That is,
I feel like I'm a big reader. I probably read, a book once a week and stuff like that. And I have a massive library and stuff like that. I read nonfiction completely, mostly history and things like that. But once you're done, and these books could easily be 500 to 700 pages and stuff like that. So you finally made it through your book, and then you flick a page, and then they say, oh, but there is an alternative ending. And you go, you gotta be kidding.
No, good point.
I can't remember what album. If it was Fuel or Reload with Metallica, that was 16 tracks on. And this is a band that basically almost sounds the same on every song. And I remember the only time I listened to that album, by the time I'd gotten to the 16th track, I was like, you got to be goddamn kidding. I can't remember any of the tracks of that album.
Yeah, because
that's a good point.
That was the Load and then the Reload album, where it was just like, this is all the songs that didn't make it onto Load that we didn't feel were good enough to put on Load, so we put it on another album.
Oh my god! Oh my god! Reload.
And isn't that one of the weirdest things, where it's just kind of like yeah, this wasn't good enough to make an album, but you know what? We're going to make it with it anyways, right?
Well, this comes back to the old thing, bigger is better, or, quantity over quality. And I go the opposite way. I just think there, and thank God right now that vinyl is back in the way, which of course is sort of why I try to prevent going over that classic 22 and a half minutes that in reality is the maximum per side of vinyl, which is why all classic albums have, I'm sure somebody's going to correct me, but most likely have 10 songs on, 5 songs on each album. And so I will stick to that.
And I think that's great, honestly. Like, I know, because I'm a guy who listens to discography, so I'll, like, pick a band and I'll just start listening to them from album one and go to the end. And one of the things that I often notice, especially when you talk about the classic rock bands, is that those first albums that are 10 songs, often they're, like, 40 minutes long because they fit on a record. Those are tight. They are good, and it's just like, you listen to that, and it's like, yeah, I got it. Whereas you hit, 5-10 records later, and their album is 70 minutes long because it can go on a CD, and you're like, yeah, I mean, there's about 5 filler songs on there and 10 really good songs.
Exactly. No. And I'm sure there probably some kind of scientist or doctor that could come up with that after 45 minutes, you need a break.
I think you're probably right. The album was recorded at Medley Studios, and the co-owner that helped produce it, you've worked with them before in the past. I'm just wondering what Soren Anderson brings to the table for you.
Well, I mean, interesting enough, that is the first album that I did with Soren when I started working, and then, we ended up doing 6 albums together. And he was actually the first one who actually understood my songwriting and where I wanted to go with my music. So when we connected working on that album, it was you know guaranteed for me to continue with him. And it's simply just when somebody just adds and extends what you're doing instead of cutting it off and leading it in a different direction. And you know, just being able to be your sort of, the devil's advocate there, in a positive way of really understanding that, but this is who my tramp is, instead of, there's so many, producers. I mean, this is not being produced. I come in with my songs. I know how I'm going to sound, but I like giving Soren some freedom and coming up with some great guitar parts and stuff like that. And we're both a big fan of middle of the road country music. I think that where country, cross over to, rock and roll and some of the great artists would be Bob Seger or Creedence Clearwater Revival or Springsteen or Tom Petty, John Cougar Mellencamp, where it's not just, pickup trucks and beer, but more the strumming and the chord progression and the feeling of electric guitars blending well with acoustic guitars and stuff like that.
Now, another relationship that you've had for a long time, of course, is Mighty Music. And I mean, you're very prolific with your album releasing now. And so how does Mighty Music kind of help you along with that?
Well, I mean, in today's world, there's not the big record company anymore. So we're like four people. And Michael, who owns Mighty Music, him and I have been friends for 25 years, and we complement each other with that. We know where we want to go with it. We know what we're up against, and we know that we will only wanting to try to achieve what's realistic and possible, and not dream or go for something. So, from the start, when I started and tell myself, I got the songs for the next album and stuff like that, we know that we want to try to keep the budget under control. And, I'm able to record most of the album at home and stuff like that. So it's like, ping pong. I play the ball and the ball comes back and, we know who my tramp is and we don't want my tramp to be anybody but my tramp.
Mm-hmm. Now, given everything, of course, with so much quarantining, do you find that for you, do you want to record more songs? Do you want to work on more songs? Or do you want to actually just kind of work on the farm?
Well, I mean, actually, next Friday, Soren and a keyboard player is coming by here because I just started working on four songs. So they're just coming by. We're just going to, because they also got cabin fever. So they said, how about if we come by? He says, let's work on some of your songs, and then maybe we'll do a video and post of us playing a song, stuff like that. So, these are things that happens, But, every day, because I don't have to practice my music. I prepare for a tour, and so my vocal cords are used to singing every night and stuff like that. But my music is an extension of me. I've written the songs. I mean, they're always there, So I think right now it's just important to get away from the TV. First of all, I don't watch TV, but I have a tendency to wanting to scour the world on the newspapers and the websites around the world just for maybe half an hour in the morning. But now I'll turn that off too, because I haven't found anything that's helpful or encouraging. So I'll wait it out. I look at the sky and, I have trees outside and, birds are singing, right now I just harvested one of the big fields. So, there's a lot of falcons in the air looking for mice and stuff like that. And to me, that is life flourishing.
Is that kind of then these four songs? Is that the inspiration? Do you find an inspiration there working the farm? Does that help your music?
No, it helps me that, I don't go from the studio to another environment of the same thing. Like, many bands, would be in the studio and they would go down to the bar and drink and play pool, hang out there. I do the opposite. I go out and smell cow shit. So when I come in, the music is much more clear to me because I'm 100% away from it. So there's nothing in the music that sounds like where I am. It's just that the environment makes it a nice break.
Okay. So what is the inspiration then for the new songs?
Well, I'm not really inspired by anything, because when I sit there, you know, I'm one of these guitar players that never play anybody but my own songs, where everybody else I play with, the first thing they do is like either like Whole Lotta Love or Walk This Way or something like that when they're going to test the guitar. And I say, well, that's the difference between you and me. I'm a songwriter, you're a soldier. You know, so the second I pick up a guitar, I start writing. I don't necessarily need to finish a song, and I might just decide that I'm not going to go on with this and just put it down. But the first thing I start playing will be something new. And maybe after a short while, I'll decide to sing to it or won't sing to it. So the inspiration comes from what comes back at me from the first thing I do. And if I feel it's something and I feel like I'm clearing my mind and I have a little bit of energy to wanting to go further, you know, I'll keep writing it and I'll just, you know, record it on the telephone and stuff like that. And then later on, I'll pick it up and go, oh, okay, now I turn the studio on. So I don't need to go outside and look at the blue sky to get inspired and things like that. You know, the inspiration comes from the feelings in my soul and everything. And once I start, you know, because I don't start singing the perfect words from the beginning. It's, you know, I just start mumbling. And sometimes there's two or three words that stick out that maybe becomes the focus of the song, that even though it's not the story of, you know, that I had in my head that started the song, but there's a word that is a key word in the story I want to tell, and it inspires me to tell that story.
Interesting. You know, we've talked to an awful lot of people. Nobody's ever described it like that to me before. Nobody has.
A lot of people look at songwriting as a job and something they sit and do, and you know, you start with a guitar riff and stuff like that, things like that. You know, it's to me, that's just the way it is, and the melody and stuff like that. I mean, I usually write a song within 10 or 15 minutes. It comes together there. You know, I can then down the line, you know, perfecting the chord change and things like that. And, you know, once a counter bass note comes on, you know, the song grows. It gets wider and wider. It gets bigger in the picture. But the basic of the song, the verse, the chorus, and maybe a C part is written instantly, because it comes after another. The chorus is inspired by what the verse was.
So given kind of the shift in your music from the sound of White Lion to kind of this Americana or Heartland rock sound that kind of is more now what you're doing, when you're performing, what do you find that the audience is wanting? Are they receptive to both different sounds? Do you try and how do you kind of mix them together?
Well, you know, I think it maybe started out 50-50, you know, in the beginning, a lot of people came and stuff like that. And, you know, now as we're down the road with solo albums and things like that, more and more people come and they say, oh, we like your new stuff much better, man, you know. And so, I mean, it's you know how it is. There's always someone that calls out for a song you're not playing.
Yes. You can't play everybody's favorite song, that's for sure.
No. You just have to play my favorite songs. That's the only one I care about.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know.
Now, I'm interested, too, because you talk about songwriting. Now, when it comes to naming the albums, I mean, you've got some fantastic names. I mean, you've got, like, Stray from the Flock. I mean, even going back, Cobblestone Street. I mean, really good names. Now, where do they come in the process?
Well, I mean, they're all connected to who I am and sort of like overall, you know, if you were to describe the DNA of my tramp, you were talking about before that a lot of your life seems to be about, you know, the road or the journey, et cetera, et cetera, you know, and so a lot of there you have Nomad. And then you have maybe Tomorrow, which was a solo album after that. And that's sort of the anticipation about maybe tomorrow you will reach that spot. And then you have Stray from the Flock, which is a tongue-in-cheek comment on that I am not where you think I would be based upon where I came from. I am one of those who strayed from the flock already in the early 90s. And since then, I have never ventured back to that. And you know, there are some people that get that point. There are some people that need to be told that. And of course, second time around, I mean, it is that, like I sort of quoted inside the album, you know, if life gives you that second time around, consider yourself lucky and grab it, because we all look back and say, man, if I could do this over, I wouldn't have sung this melody. I wouldn't have sung this high. I wouldn't have styled my hair this way. I wouldn't have wore those tight pants. I wouldn't have said this shit and stuff like that. So you don't get to do that. But if you do get a second chance to do something, do it the correct way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Do you think much about your legacy, as a musician? Is it something that's on your mind?
Yes and no. You know, I'm not trying to create it, but the further I get and you know, from there on looking back, I see that it's shaping itself up being incredible consistent for the last 25 years, and that is my legacy.
And I mean, that's a great legacy. I mean, you know, to be able to consistently, like, I mean, you're living one of the rock and roll dreams, right? I mean, it's to be able to consistently release your music with nobody else, you know, forcing you to do anything, and actually just being able to tell the stories that you want to tell. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, I think that is truly one of the rock and roll dreams.
And you've earned it.
Well, you know, I've never said this before, and I'm not trying to make myself any more than what I am. But I can tell you one thing, that I am the one and only artist from the 80s of all the bands you would connect with White Line and all the bands that were slogging it out during the 80s that have done 12 solo albums consistently. There is not one single artist from the 80s that have done that.
No, there isn't.
No,
I can't.
When you find one, call me up and I will swallow my words.
No, there isn't. You know what? I mean,
I'm not saying it to make myself any more so like I'm only talking about being consistent, that when I decided to record my first solo album, it was also a commitment for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, because, you know, so often it's so easy to want to just follow the money and chase everything and you know, to keep going back to relive the past glories and to try to get the band back together and all that stuff. And I know you went back to White Lion, but I mean, now I know that your focus truly is your solo album, solo career.
Yeah, I mean, of course. I mean, I'd never go back, and that short moment I had in about 2005 and 2007, where I fell off the track, you know, and for a short moment thought that I was going to create a new version of White Lion. I've been the first one out there to apologize and admit that was solely my mistake, and it was something that I completely regretted doing it. And I felt it the first night I stood on stage trying to be sort of my tramp 1988. And I'm happy that I got away from that as quick as I could.
Well, and in this case too, I mean, you can't, it truly can't happen again. I mean, really, like, there's no, it doesn't seem like there is any path towards the original band reuniting, right? So...
Not even if it would be the vaccine to cure Corona.
Yeah, that's pretty serious then. Well, no, I know
that's
that
pretty
it just
serious,
passed. I know that it just passed 11 o'clock there in Denmark because, well, you know, I Listening to you and talking to you, it makes me want to go home. Boy, because every time I step in there's just something about it that grounds me in the country of Denmark.
Well, please let me know if you ever make the journey here. I'll be gladly to hook up with you and
show you around. That would be fantastic. Yeah, that would be tremendous. So thank you so much, for your time. It'd be fascinating, and there's, a billion things we can dig into, but just really interested to hear your perspectives and how you look at things. I think I've learned a lot here, which is something that when it's a really good podcast, really good interview, I feel like I always learn something. So thank you so much, Mike. Why don't you tell everybody where to keep up with the latest from Mike Trapp?
Well, I mean, we would try to simplify it. So basically these days, Mike Trapp official Facebook is where it's at, man. I do have a website, miketrapp.dk, but most people seem to want the quick fix, and that's Facebook. It's as simple as that.
Well, yeah, it's the way it is right now. But Well, I'm truly happy that you have the new album second time around coming out May 1st. And honestly, I urge everybody to go and listen to it because, wonderful music. You are a wonderful guest, Mike. And thank you so much for your time and just all the best and be safe and healthy.
Thanks for your kind words, guys. And thanks for your praise of my songs and my music and my 44 years in rock and roll. My door is always open to you guys. So let's hope we'll talk or meet each other in the very near future.
Absolutely. Also, wasn't for COVID-19, I'd probably be over there already. So I was planning a trip and thinking about a trip.
And then, likewise.
Yeah, it's too bad. But
you got it.
Thank you so much. Tuck.
Thank you, guys.
Tuck. Tuck.
Thanks, Mike.
Good night.
Good night, bro.
Good night.
Back to the wall, you would fight for your life. Held your own.